This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Medical errors is a pretty general headline on a lot of different problems, from lost documents and test reports to hospital-acquired infections and amputation errors. The problem goes from bad to extremely bad, and some of the efforts made to solve the problems haven't really helped.
There will be problems that we can't even anticipate, and we have to welcome those problems and solve them as opposed to deny their existence.
On today's Health Show, we'll talk to an editor of the new book, First Do Less Harm, Confronting the Inconvenient Problems of Patient Safety.
We'll also explore the concept of shared living and how it's helping seniors remain independent by relying on each other. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. Each year, hospital-acquired infections, prescribing and treatment errors, lost documents and test reports, communication failures, and other problems have caused thousands of deaths in the U.S., added millions of days to patients' hospital stays, and cost Americans tens of billions of dollars. Despite, and well, sometimes because of, new medical information technology and numerous well-intentioned initiatives to address these problems, threats to patient safety remain, and in some areas are on the rise. In the new book, First Do Less Harm, 12 healthcare professionals and researchers, plus two former patients, look at patient safety from a variety of perspectives, finding many of the proposed solutions to be inadequate or impractical. Here to talk about the book is the co-editor, journalist Suzanne Gordon. We spoke recently, and I asked just how safe we are once we get inside those hospital doors.
We have a lot to worry about. Over 100,000 people a year die of preventable complications in hospitals, and probably in every hospitalization, there's one medication administration error per day. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're not caught, but it's pretty dangerous to go into a hospital. Hospitals are not safe places, and obviously there's some risks that can't be prevented, but there's some risks that can be prevented. And our book is really intended to help people understand what they can do and what we need to pay attention to in the effort to make patients safer.
Well, I want to talk about the book. It's structured in a very interesting way as a series of essays. How did you decide who was going into this book, and how did you decide what the subject matter was going to be, or did one decide the other?
Well, it was a bit of both. I mean, we wanted to really discuss things that aren't on the radar in the patient safety movement. We wanted to discuss things like sleep. There's a fairly robust discussion about how fatigue affects the performance of medical residents, interns, i.e. doctors in training, but very little discussion of how fatigue affects veteran doctors or doctors who finish their training. And there's even less discussion of how sleep impacts nurses, and since nurses are working longer hours. So we chose three researchers who have been on the forefront of discussions of sleep research in physicians and nurses. We wanted to look at hospital cleanliness and hospital outsourcing, so we picked an international expert, Rosalind Stanwell Smith in Britain, who's written about hospital cleanliness and how hospitals are now outsourcing a lot of hospital cleaning, and people go into a hospital assuming that it's clean. Well, just because it's tidy doesn't mean it's clean in the way it needs to be clean to prevent you from getting a superbug like methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus and dying or having some horrible amputation or something. My co-editor, Ross Capel, is an expert on healthcare information technology or healthcare HIT, and so we have a big chapter on the problems of HIT and also a really astonishing chapter by a guy named Joseph Bugoski, who wrote about this thing called the data model that nearly killed me, about how in a world-renowned hospital with the latest healthcare information technology and computerized records, the computerization is so anti-staff that people would kind of ignore it and basically ignored things that needed to be done, wasted time doing things that didn't need to be done, and he essentially had to almost save himself. And I write a lot about teamwork and hospital hierarchy and so forth. So it flowed from what we are working on and what we consider critical issues that aren't being addressed.
I want to go back to what you said about the computer systems and the essay on the medical computer system that almost killed the guy. I've been in radio
for my entire adult life, and I have seen how going from just using tapes and records to electronic recording, and it's really been a godsend. It really helps do our job a lot easier, but some of the systems you can tell were designed by computer geniuses who had never seen the inside of a radio studio. And you didn't know how to operate the thing. It works if you knew how to do it because it was done for a computer person and not a radio person. It seems like the medical records, some of them anyway, are being done the same way. They work wonderfully, but they're just so clunky they're impossible to use in an actual clinical setting.
Right, and this ties in with the theme of another one of our essays that I co-wrote with Samuel Sammy and Peter Lazzies, one of whom is at Cornell University's ILR Industrial Labor Program, the other at Maimonides Hospital. And we argue in that essay that too many patient safety initiatives are designed at the top and then they're sort of imposed at the bottom. And this HIT, this healthcare information technology, is the perfect example of that. I mean, you have people who don't understand what the imperatives of bedside care are. They design these things in some little office or their little computer station, and it's all very well and good, but they don't include, not to mention even consult, but include in the design and implementation the people who are the users. And if you don't do that, you get what Bogoski got, which is essentially you have to save yourself in the hospital. I mean, his story is worth the whole book. It's just an astonishing story of very well-meaning people who, you know, are very well-trained and who are just stymied. And I think that what ends up happening with all this healthcare HIT and computerization is that the computer becomes a patient. So the doctor or nurse or pharmacist is taking care of two patients, the real patient and then the computer. And the computer actually wins. And I think that Ross Capel's essay on the many, many problems of healthcare information technology is an excellent example of how we are serving technology instead of having technology to serve us. And we're not anti-technology. But, I mean, what ends up happening is it becomes like the emperor's new clothes, and people get very invested in these multi-million dollar systems, and then they really don't want to acknowledge the problems. And if we could only say, look, there's no silver bullet, you know, everything has problems. Everything is going to generate problems. And we have to be ready to acknowledge those problems. And we have to be able to acknowledge problems that we can't even anticipate. You know, we have to be aware that there will be problems that we can't even anticipate. And we have to welcome those problems and solve them as opposed to deny their existence because, my God, we just got sold this bill of goods by some HIT vendor and we spent millions of dollars and how can we admit, you know, that this thing really isn't working so well. Well, of course it's not going to necessarily work perfectly in a complex system. So let's figure out and design into its implementation the figuring out of its problems.
And then, of course, it was the story of the really good system that was installed in the rooms in such a way that if you used it, you'd get hit in the head when they opened the door.
Oh, yeah, this was great. This is at a major teaching hospital in the West. And they put in computer systems, and they put them in the patient's room so that the nurses could use them, and they didn't consult the nurses about placement. So they put them at a height that would be ergonomically wrong for the nurses to use and would cause a lot of injuries, and also right behind a door that opens, and if the door is closed, it slams right into the nurse who's using it and gives them a back or head injury. And, you know, then they had to remove them all. I mean, but, you know, we have to consult the users. If you would have consulted the users, they would have told you right away. But we have this notion that there's the mindful people and the mindless people, and the mindful people, most of whom are the ones who have the least contact with the patient. And same is true of teamwork. I mean, you would think as a patient that people who take care of you in a hospital talk to each other. They don't even know each other's names. They don't even do basic introductions. They walk into a room with their gowns covered because the patient has an infection. Hi, we're HemOnc. Now, that means hematology oncology, which means in English cancer and blood diseases. They don't even have names, the doctors and nurses, and nobody even objects to this, you know. How do you go back and find HemOnc? I mean, the most rudimentary things that we do in everyday life and that high-reliability industries do, like making introductions, are not done in healthcare. And if you're a patient in a hospital or family member, All you have to do is turn on your brain and watch when they come in the room, and you'll see that the doctor doesn't introduce himself to the nurse, the doctor doesn't brief the nurse, the nurse doesn't ask for a briefing, the nurse doesn't introduce herself to the doctor. And the basics of teamwork, like knowing who's on your team or knowing what the function of the people on the team are. Well, could you imagine the quarterback saying, you know, could you explain the role of the defensive end? I've never been really clear on that.
Are colleges and teaching hospitals trying to help bridge that communication gap?
Well, they are now. I mean, there people are trying to deal with this, and there's all kinds of efforts to do. There's a great program called Team Steps that was developed by ARC and the Department of Defense. It's done in some hospitals. There's efforts to do interprofessional education. There's a great journal called the Journal of Interprofessional Care, but it's really at the very beginnings. In Canada, they're doing it much more than they are here, and it's funded by the government. I mean, there is a great model, and we talk about it in the book, which is, of course, the aviation industry, which dealt with the problem of autocratic captains and people being afraid to tell the autocratic captain he was flying into the mountain and everybody going down with the plane, including the captain. And they've done a lot of work on that. And if you talk to Sullenberger, I just was at an event and asked him some questions yesterday about crew resource management, which is the communication training that they do, communication, teamwork, workload management. It's very complex. The problem is we have a model that can be adapted to healthcare where they teach people how to communicate, how to manage their workload together, how to build teams. And it's a great model, and it's unarguably saved lives, and you just don't have the kind of crashes that we were having, like a lot of crashes before this happened. There's enormous resistance in healthcare to adapting that model to healthcare, but there's a lot we can learn. It's not rocket science, you know, to introduce yourself when you walk into a room, to give a briefing to a nurse, to wash your hands before you touch a patient or after, clean your hands after. But, you know, there's tremendous resistance. I mean, here's a simple thing that could be very transformative. Doctors, take off your ties. If you see a doctor in a hospital wearing a tie, ask them why they're wearing a tie. And if they come near you with a tie on, ask them to take it off. In the United Kingdom, in the National Health Service, they have a rule called naked below the elbows. So no ties, no lab coats, no long nails, no jewelry, because ties and lab coats and, you know, long fingernails and jewelry, it's all vectors for disease. And taking off your tie requires no money at all. It's the least expensive and a very effective thing that could be done tomorrow in the United States, in North America. And it's very effective because people do not launder their ties every night. And it wouldn't matter if they laundered their tie every night because you're just going, you know, the tie falls into the patient, it gets germs on it, falls into the next patient, or the you know, gets germs on it, doctor touches tie, doctor touches face, doctor touches door, doctor touches patient, boom.
How does the bureaucracy of dealing with different insurance companies with different rules for each one hurt patient care?
This is another communications nightmare. And in fact, billing, because we have no national health system in the United States, separate requirements of each hospital billing all these different insurance companies adds complexity to these HIT systems, which are designed to serve too many masters. And very often, if there's a glitch in the technology and it needs to be shut down and fixed, the hospital will say, well, we can't do that because we use the computer for billing. And so you begin to wonder, you know, what is the primary goal of this system, to bill or to take care of patients?
Well, then you've also got the dealings of union and management, which is adversarial anyway.
Right, but I mean, unions are the only way that people can raise these issues safely if they're workers. And one of the chapters that we have, we discuss the issue of how, you know, when they implement a lot of patient safety technology, the hospitals don't want to include unions if they're unionized in the design and implementation because they're too adversarial in their relationships with unions and they don't bring unions on board. Unions can't function in the workplace if they don't cooperate. And a lot of times, quote, the word adversarial means I say jump and you don't say how high. And in a relationship, if there's a dysfunctional relationship, it takes two people to make the dysfunction. And also, a lot of times, hospitals say that unions are adversarial because they're just sticking up for the rights of workers and patients. I mean, unions have been some of the most strong advocates for patient safety measures. If you look at staffing ratios that the California Nurses Association has fought for in California, this is a real major patient safety initiative that is often not discussed as a patient safety initiative, and it was initiated by a union.
Along with Ross Koppel, journalist Suzanne Gordon is the co-editor of the book, First, Do Less Harm, Confronting the Inconvenient Problems of Patient Safety.
Still to come, a group of elders is trying to redefine the shared living experience. That story's next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1265.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs. For a lot of people, moving out on your own is a sign of growing older and more independent. That may include sharing a place with a roommate for financial reasons until you get on your feet and finally get a place to call your own. And that's pretty much the way it stays, probably with a spouse and family joining in, until perhaps a nursing home brings you back to a shared living experience. But today's generation of elders is rethinking how they want to live in their advancing years. Radio Netherlands' Marnie Chesterton has more.
A cluster of houses built on a single piece of land, with common spaces to socialise in. Dinners three times a week, shared resources. It's not a hippie commune of the 1960s. This is called co-housing, and more people of all ages are finding themselves drawn to the idea. Craig Ragland, the executive director of the Co-Housing Association of the United States, explained the attraction.
People need each other, and that particularly becomes the case as we become older. Seniors in the United States, at least, have a lot of them have lost the connection. We isolate them into age groups, into stratified groups, and they don't have connection with the broader community.
It's weird, though, because co-housing is something I associate with kids at college. And, you know, you get your own room, but you share a kitchen and a fridge.
In our case, we have a common house that has a large kitchen with a large dining room that's designed that it can be used on a day-to-day basis. But every home has a private kitchen that their family uses for meals that they're not eating together.
You have shared meals?
We have five shared meals a week in my community. The average is three per week.
What if you don't want to go and share meals?
Then you don't go and share meals.
Okay.
I mean, there's very little in the co-housing sphere that's compulsory other than paying your homeowner's dues and meeting, you know, you meet what agreements you've made.
Is there a kind of person for whom shared housing would be suitable?
It's entirely self-selection, so it's people that find it attractive. It tends to be people that are more progressive and looking for alternatives and open to alternatives. There's often a lot of fear in the United States about losing privacy or about being less independent. But what I've discovered is that living in a co-housing situation actually enables you to be more independent.
What's the biggest surprise for most older people when they move to a co-housing situation?
Coming to understand just how important it is to be in a relationship to other people and how meaningful that can be to them. Having people that need you and that you need creates a much richer life for people. You hear stories of older people that die in their homes and are there for weeks without being discovered. And that idea is absurd in a co-housing community.
I was reading this great bit in this article, this guy going, oh, I'd love to do co-housing, but I'm not old enough for this yet. And his wife said, you're 80, you're never going to be old enough for this. So come on, just do it.
There's a challenge amongst seniors because it's very difficult to make changes the older you get. And it's unclear how well you'll be able to adapt into a co-housing community if you're old. The way that the more common pattern is younger, older people, 50s, 60s, 70s are the ones that are actually moving into these communities. Unfortunately, if you wait too long, you often will end up in a community that's not your choice, some type of a retirement facility that's designed for other people serving you, whereas co-housing is about people serving each other and supporting and finding ways to help each other, making agreements about what level of care the community is willing to step up and provide. And that varies community by community. So if you want to be part of defining that, you need to be involved very early in the community's life.
So it's about engineering your environment to suit you as an older person.
Exactly. It's a better place to age successfully. You have people around you that are watching out for you. Again, the level of care varies based on the agreements within the community and to some degree within the agreements between the individuals and their community. Both of the founding members of the community where I live have passed away now. One of them died of ALS, and he received an extraordinary level of care as his needs increased over the 3 years between his diagnosis and the time that he passed. He invited the community to participate in his final journey. And at the time, he was still quite healthy.
And what did people do to help that normally would have been done by a hospital or a nurse?
Well, the norm here would be that at some point he would be institutionalized or would have been institutionalized. In his case, he was able to have a death at home surrounded by his family and by his loving neighbors.
And what was the kind of age range of people helping?
I guess Alex was about 3 or 4 years old, and the helping he provided was just sort of spirit lift and, you know, being present for Fred and you know, he'd come in and ask him questions and, you know, for a three-year-old, if you think about it, actually having some conversation about Fred's not going to be here forever and he's going to be dying. And, you know, that's sort of on the young end. And on the other end, a 77-year-old that was actually older than Fred was a caregiver. And she provided massages and helped with feeding. And part of what Fred needed was constant attention. And so there we organized and had shifts and provided much of that. Near the end, they also the family did hire a care provider. And so he would spend some of the nights with Fred to give respite because the level of care just got so extreme. When you have people around you that know what your wishes are, they can help make it happen. And it's very hard for you know, a spouse to support their spouse's wishes near the end. It's such a traumatic, hard time for the spouse. And often in the United States, it's a distant relative that's, you know, flying in to have those conversations about what do we do with mom? We need to be able to age successfully. We need to be able to participate in those decisions. And so what we've done or what we're doing in co-housing is intentionally creating that strong neighborhood.
Craig Ragland, thank you very much, and good luck with spreading the word.
That report from Radio Netherlands, Marnie Chesterton.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.